This week's Meet and Three is all about food branding and identity in 2020. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
Everybody has some Goya product in their pantry. So obviously the biggest kind of loss from all of this is the students really working with a brand that they're very comfortable with, that they're very familiar with.
I'll be honest, I was completely floored. I was very surprised that a company, especially in the current climate, would backtrack out of a commitment to address issues of racism.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee. Learn about the wonderfully tart Montmorency cherry at choosecherries.com.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro, and we have a sweet show for you today as we talk all about baking traditions in the Midwest. Our first guest literally wrote the book on it. Shauna Seaver is a former entertainment reporter turned baker extraordinaire. She began developing and writing recipes when she launched her award-winning baking blog, Piece of Cake, in 2007. Since then, Shauna has contributed food stories, recipes, and expert tips for numerous outlets, including The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Food 52, Bon Appetit, The Kitchen, Family Circle, Real Simple, Midwest Living, and the list goes on and on. It's a pretty impressive list, I have to say. But she's done even more than that, ladies and gentlemen. Over the last several years, Shauna has written a number of baking-focused cookbooks, including the one we're going to be talking about today, Midwest Made, released in 2019. Very important to the show, Shauna is a Midwestern native of Chicago and has returned to her homeland after a stint on the West Coast. Boy, oh boy, Shauna, you are the woman. And I was telling you before offline, I am already a groupie and I want to be you when I grow up after reading the Midwest Made book. So thank you. I'm so excited to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much. That was such a lovely introduction.
Well, thanks. So I spent a lot of time with the cookbook and actually read the introduction. I feel like a lot of times people don't read introductions to cookbooks. They go straight in. But for me, I feel like, you know, you want the context, right? And it provided a lot of context. And there was this one sentence in the intro that really resonated with me because it kind of is at the soul of what this show and this series is all about. So I'll read the quote. Your words, without immigrants, this book you're holding, Midwest Made, its author, that would be you, and the region's unique cultural landscape at large simply wouldn't exist. So true. So I want to know, how did your ethnic identity inform your cooking and this cookbook specifically?
Well, my ethnic identity is one that I think is really tied to the Midwest. I refer to myself in the book as being a Midwestern mutt, which is just sort of a funny way of saying there's a little bit of everything in my background.
Right.
My grandfather was Greek and Sicilian. Both of his parents were immigrants from those countries. And then my grandmother kind of was a mashup of Irish, Swedish, and German. Mm-hmm. And so we had a really eclectic family table. I had a very, you know, a tight extended family while I was growing up, and food was always a huge part of the story. And so we saw lots of different types of dishes growing up. It never occurred to me that it was unusual to have, you know, such a different mix of dishes on the table. And for the holidays, of course, it was classic all-American cooking. But, you know, my grandfather was also very into gardening really strong Greek olive oils and strong cheeses at a time in the 80s where a lot of people in the Midwest were not, you know, visiting those markets, but that was the food that he grew up with. And so those flavors really influenced me growing up in a way that I didn't really, you know, like a lot of people, I took it for granted. You take the things of your youth as being kind of normal. And then going to California for 13 years and sort of realizing, that those things you don't find. I mean, of course, now you find things more, you know, it's easier to find all kinds of great markets out there. But specifically sure. with baking, you know, the bakeries of the Midwest really mm-hmm. showcase that immigrant influence as well. And so I wanted that to be a really big part of the story of the book. And I think it's what makes the region so unique.
No question about it. And I noticed in the book, so many of these ethnic type of pastries, and you have a whole ode to kolache. And I actually, on a totally different episode, talked about kolache at length. But, you know, kolache is in there. I think you have pushkis as well. You know, give me some examples of some of these ethnic pastries that you included into the book, because I'm sure that our listeners want to hear about them and probably want to make them after they hear about them.
A lot of them actually show up in the very first chapter, which is the sweet doughs chapter. And that's because a lot of the great old world baking traditions come from the European countries, particularly Eastern European countries, and those people who then brought those recipes to the Midwest. Most of them were, you know, really gifted farmers. And so the great farming opportunities in the Midwest is what brought a lot of our immigrants to us yep. here. And so with that comes the really old school way of baking with yeast before there was any sort of, you know, baking powder to be, you know, that didn't come into play until the late 1800s. So the earlier part of that century, you had people bringing these yeast risen doughs that they just did the most incredible things with. And so, like you said, you know, the punschki is one of those. Those are a yeast raised donut. And the houska, which is a Czech bread that's like a braided mm-hmm. bread, kind of similar to a brioche, really delicious. And then potica, which is another Czech bread. Or it can be Slovenian, and it has a couple different pronunciations, but that's that really beautiful walnut sort of swirled bread that you see.
Right.
And, you know, such a simple dough. There's a buttery yeast raised coffee cake dough that's in that chapter that is the building block for a number of different recipes. And that's really how a lot of the early bakers of the Midwest operated. They had a couple of really great foundation recipes and just got really creative with it. And that's a big part of the Midwestern story with food as well, is just the innovation and using what you have
Absolutely.
To make something new and never being wasteful. I mean, that's a huge part of the story.
Yeah, every guest that we've had on this show thus far has said exactly that. There are these repetitive themes when we talk about Midwest and Midwestern foodways, and you're bringing them all up here again, which is great, and putting them into practice in one book and in one area, which is baking, which is why I really wanted to have you on the show. So I know that, you know, you didn't just use recipes from, you know, your family. It's my understanding you actually traveled the region in the Midwest to research for this book. So, gosh, I can imagine that was one heck of an adventure. do you happen to have any stories, favorite stories from your time on the road when you were researching for this?
Yes.
Inquiring minds want to know.
One of the greatest things about traveling for this book is that most Midwesterners are just so, you know, not close to the vest with their family recipes, but they certainly don't.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure?
They certainly don't. Either they keep them top secret, or they're like, why do you want to know about that? You know, like, that's just such a regular old thing, themselves not realizing that, no, things like punschki are special. You know, you don't find them on the coasts, you know, or if you do, you find them by another name. And so the history of them is different here. And so people, once they found out that I was interested in these things, you know, they really want to open up to you, because people don't usually dig deeper about these kinds of recipes. And certainly when I started writing this book, as you said, there are family recipes in the book. And that was really the underlying spirit of it.
Sure.
Like any author, you write from your own experience to start with. But, you know, going back to those immigrant influences, knowing there was going to be such a deeper story if I brought that part into it. And then when you travel to pockets of the country, like areas in Minnesota, for example, that still have such a strong Scandinavian influence, and so they have all those pastries, or in Wisconsin, you have some towns that are extremely German, and so you're going to find some great stuff in the bakeries there. But one of my favorite trips specifically in making the book was going to Iowa. I did like a 4 or 5 day trip from Chicago to a little bit past Des Moines with one of my best friends who's actually an Iowa native. And so it was just really fun for her too to kind of learn more of this stuff that she had there. People were so open in sharing ideas, like, you got to go here and you got to go there.
Yes.
And we had this crazy list just from talking to the servers at restaurants we stopped at and things like that. But the Yarsma Bakery, which is in Pella, Iowa, which has a really deep Dutch history, they're known for their Dutch letters. And so that's one of the Iowa recipes that ended up in the book. And, you know, the bakery has all the, you know, the tulips outside and the little, you know, white and blue pottery and the wooden shoes.
Love it.
And the whole thing. I mean, it's fabulous, really fabulous, and a really fun recipe too. And so that's kind of what that area is known for and how one of the ways that Iowa ended up being represented. But yes, there was a lot of great travel and actually a lot of digging deeper right in my hometown in Chicago, sure. Which of course
there's so much, sure.
So much, yeah. There's so much that you can find just in this one city. It's really that's a great influence as well. I think if I was from another part of the Midwest, I wouldn't have had such a strong sense of all of the different influences that are here. And you try and cover as much as you can and what the majority right. is. I mean, I wish I could put every great, you know, Vietnamese pastry from Minnesota or go into some of the Somalian desserts. And it's just right. I decided to sort of write from what I knew. Rather than trying to put myself as some sort of food historian expert, you know,
sure,
and make it a more personal book.
But look, I mean, I think just this conversation, I think, is showing, or at least, you know, speaking since we're on the radio to listeners and to the audience, exactly what I'm hoping to convey is that the Midwest is more than just this meat and potatoes. You know, you're talking about all of this cornucopia of different flavors, different ethnicities, different types of pastries, and you don't think about that necessarily. And so this really, I think, gives, I hope, at least I hope, that insight and that journey to listeners to get at least a taste of all of the different types of things that are in the Midwest. And I know that, you know, your book tries to do that as well. So one thing that I really was interested in, again, in reading the intro and in Midwest Made, you kind of put baking into the context of the Midwest, kind of, you know, basically putting this concept of baking into the Midwest food is a state of mind, right? So you have five baking tenets of the Great Midwest. Please walk us through those five and why they are the baking tenets of the Great Midwest.
Yes. So these were really the guideposts that I developed for myself really early on, even when I was crafting the proposal, because I knew, first of all, doing something so personal and something so complex was going to really need some clear sort of entry points into a really mm-hmm. vast amount of information and recipes. And so what I did for myself is I defined the five baking tenets of the Midwest as bake big, bake easy, bake with purpose, bake in the present, and bake in the past. And, you know, bake big, meaning big batches, like the 9x13 is the quintessential symbol of Midwestern hospitality.
Absolutely. On for everything, whether it's a hot dish or a cake.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's about sharing, you know, feeding a crowd. And of course, with baking easy, you know, you want to keep it simple and you want to use what you have first and foremost. And then if you have to add a special ingredient here and there, you can do that. Bake with purpose is one of those things. That's why I love baking in general and why I've chosen to make that my food writing career and not savory food, because for me, there's always going to be a reason why we bake. I always say that we have to cook, but we get to bake. Like baking is always going
to
be,
yeah,
it's always going to be something beyond the everyday, right? Like whether it's a birthday or it could just be a Wednesday night, and you're really craving something to watch, you know, with your trashy show you're going to see or whatever it is you want to have. So, I mean, there's a reason why you're going to create something, right? Which is great.
Right.
And the baking in the present is very much about, you know, trying to find modern ways to innovate old school recipes, which I did a lot of for this book. There's no box Jell-O. There's no cake mix or Cool Whip. Not that there's anything wrong with those things. I still totally crave those things from time to time, and I grew up on them. But for this book, really trying to unravel a lot of those church community recipes that run on a lot of those processed ingredients.
Right, sure.
And kind of bring them into the fresher, sort of modern age, how people like to bake and eat now. And then baking from the past. I mean, you know that the tradition and upholding tradition and keeping those things alive is very much a part of the Midwestern character. And that's
absolutely
reflected in the recipes as well.
I'm going to have to keep that in mind next time I bake, because I myself am a baker. I mean, I like to cook as well, but baking is my main jam.
Yeah.
For just all those reasons. I mean, and because it does have this, when you bake, there is more, I think, sentiment, heart, there is that purpose there. You do bake for a reason. And I guess I never really thought about it. You just kind of do it, right? But when you really break it down, I can see exactly why these five tenets really were your guideposts as you approached, as you said, a very large amount of information, which is really difficult to tackle.
Yeah.
Something that I've learned doing this series as well is that it's a lot of ground, literally and figuratively, to cover.
Yes.
So I want to tie things up here, kind of looking to the future of Midwestern food, because you talked about how, in your cookbook, Midwest Made, about how much there's so much ground and heritage and recipes to cover. In an area that people consider flyover country. This term flyover country continues to come up in my work. It's a term I'm not crazy about. Maybe you're not crazy about it either. because it intrinsically means dismissive, right? And so why do you think so many have dismissed the Midwest and its food? And what can we do to change that going forward?
Well, I mean, just to make it very current, I mean, think about the foods that are most Instagrammable right now are going to be these really sort of exciting new flavor combinations,
right,
really brightly colored, running on a lot of seasonal produce all year long, which is what's so sexy and great about California cuisine. I mean, you can't deny that appeal. On the other hand, I think something that makes eating in the Midwest so special is that you're not going to find the same dish all year round. You're not going to be able to make the same salad in July as you can in January if you really want to use local ingredients, you know?
Right.
I find now that I'm back here, you know, perfect example is like all of our great strawberries just came in. Well, I fed my baby strawberries in February and they were red all the way through and gorgeous when I had them in San Francisco, you know, and now we're back here and you've got to wait for that perfect moment. And when you cut open the perfect strawberry and know that it's only going to be there for so long, you know, it becomes much more special. And I think people here understand that.
That's why we have so many fairs and festivals specifically on food. I mean, I can think of at least three strawberry festivals in Northeastern Ohio that, you know, people set their calendar, myself included, on apple festivals, zucchini festivals, pumpkin festivals, potato festivals.
Yes.
And it's that celebration of the land.
Yes. And that's exactly it. I mean, the harvest is an enormous part, you know, and the seasons are an enormous part of I think how, you know, we do our baking too, because it's not easy to make a fruit dessert in the wintertime. That's where you get more into your comfort baking, what I like to call, you know, counter cakes, those things that are really going to keep and be hearty and shareable. But I think, you know, it's just a very long time of people having this sort of certain mindset about the Midwest, that every state is the same, that the entire thing is homogenous, that, you know, and that's just simply not true. I mean, not only because even today we still have such a great mix of people from all over the world who come here to work and to live their lives, but it's the history as well, you know. And I think a lot of times these influences become so deeply embedded in the culture that you don't see them anymore. And I think it is compounded by the fact that the Midwestern character is to just not run your mouth so much. Like, you don't have to brag about every single thing. I mean, we're going to have the strawberry festival. Why do we have to, you know? And there's just this feeling of like, that's how you have to talk. Like, it is what it is, you know? And it's great, but we don't have to toot our own horn about it all the time. That's just a very Midwestern
I totally agree. But you know what? You're shining a fantastic light on that, though, through your book.
Showing people,
you know, that there is so much richness and diversity here and so many different flavors and so many different cultures. And you're not necessarily tooting your horn. You're just putting it out there for people to enjoy.
I'm glad that people have found it. One of the best things is people who are from the Midwest have found things in this book that they haven't heard of. And yeah. and at the same time, a lot of really great all-American recipes that people go, oh my God, I had no idea the roots of that were in the Midwest. And you could tell a really interesting story about a recipe that has become, you know, quintessentially just American. You know, if you want to talk about something that's flyover and bland, it's the word, you know, American. It's that
right.
You know, catch-all phrase. And some of those actually have very deep roots. It's just we don't share the story as much as we should. And so I'm glad people are finding that in the book.
Well, and I'm glad that you came on our show to tell this story, your story, and how we can together tell the story of the Midwest. Shauna Siever, thank you so much for being on Eat Your Heartland Out today.
Thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by the Michigan Cherry Committee, representing 75% of U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry production. With over 100 articles published in health journals stating the vast health benefits of Michigan superfruit, it's best to choose the cherry with more. U.S. Montmorency tart cherries. They're available year-round, dried, frozen, canned, juice, and concentrate. Learn more about the wonderfully U.S.-grown Montmorency tart cherry at choosecherries.com.
I'm delighted to be joined by my friend and colleague, Selena Zito. Selena is a journalist from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, right over the border from me in Ohio, as a matter of fact. She writes for the Washington Examiner, the New York Post, appears regularly on television and radio, and is the author of The Great Revolt about the 2016 election. So hearing all of this, you may be asking yourself, what is a political journalist from Pittsburgh doing on a show about Midwestern food? Well, you're about to find out because we're welcoming Selena right now. Hey, how are you?
Hey, Capri, how you doing?
I am great. We're so excited to have you on the show. And you're the perfect guest, actually, to bookend our last guest, Shauna Siever, who wrote the cookbook Midwestern Made. In her book, she talks about the phenomena of the cookie table. And I know that you've written about the cookie table and have made cookies for the table. So tell our listeners about your connection to the cookie table tradition and what it's all about.
What makes it even more meaningful for me to talk about this today is today's the anniversary, that a six-year anniversary, that I was hauling 3,000 cookies in the back of my Jeep, and that was all I couldn't fit anything else in the Jeep. I had to make two trips to the mountains for my daughter's wedding in 2014. I made over 3,000 cookies. I had to take 10 days off from work to pull this off. But the cookie table has been a tradition, not only in my family, but in families throughout my neighborhood, and then the neighborhoods outside of that, and the neighborhoods outside of that, for as long as I could remember, and going back as far as my grandmother's a generation who came here in the beginning of the 20th century.
Right. And so while you're from Western Pennsylvania and I'm from Northeastern Ohio, we are bordering communities very similar throughout the Rust Belt. And Shauna Siever's book, she talks about the cookie table and references my hometown of Youngstown, Ohio specifically. We didn't get into it about the cookie table because I knew I was going to have you on. And I knew that you know, really had this hands-on experience with the cookie table. You know, 3,000 cookies, that's a lot for one person to make. You said it took you 10 days, but, you know, and you obviously talked about how it's a tradition in your family, in your area, in our area. I mean, it's pervasive throughout Ohio. It's pervasive across the Italian-American communities, predominantly in the Midwest and within our region. You don't see it as much from, for example, like in New York, New Jersey, Italian. So it really is a regional thing. But Maybe you can give a little bit of context of why these cookie tables show up at weddings, what their significance is, and what kind of cookies you can actually find.
So the tradition began, and the only reason I understand this is because my grandmother explained it to me, and she was part of the generation that began this tradition. So immigrants, they didn't need to be Italian. This is a tradition that crosses a lot of ethnic groups. Polish.
I guess we just have a lot of Italians here. or people are marrying Italians, and therefore somebody's bringing the cookie table, so there's no discernment.
So the tradition began because when that first generation arrived here, that big wave of immigrants from across Europe arrived here in the beginning of the 20th century, they didn't have a lot of money. In fact, the reason that they fled, as they used to call the old country, was because there was severe poverty. But when their children married, whether they married an Italian, which was preferred if you were Italian, but also started to go across the different immigrant populations that filled places like Pittsburgh, like Youngstown, like Toledo, they wanted to show off when their daughters got married. And when their sons got married. But because they didn't have much money, the one thing they could show off were the baking traditions that they brought from the old country. So as a way of letting guests know that there was something very special about this family was for the moms and the aunts and the daughters and the granddaughters. And trust me, it was only women at that time. And there was espresso and wine involved, which had made a very unique condition at the table. But they would get together and they would make hundreds and hundreds of cookies, taking great pride in the ingredients that they used and the way that they decorated them. And they would place them on tables. Often these marriages happened in church basements, in backyards, at Uncle Leo's restaurant on the second floor. But the first thing a guest would see would be the presentation of the cookies from the old country. Now, they couldn't give their daughter an elaborate wedding. They didn't have a ton of money for the guests, but they certainly made the guests feel as though they had something special from that particular family. That tradition never ended. In fact, if you go to a wedding in Youngstown or Pittsburgh or all the places where this tradition is carried out, you don't judge what the bride's dress looks like, or the mother of the bride or the bridesmaids. That's the least concern when you walk into that wedding. It's if you have a cookie table and if you have sufficient ability to take at least 2 to 3 dozen cookies home yourself in a very nice convenient container.
That is truth. I mean, it doesn't matter, what's going on? The cookie table is really the star of the show, even more than the bride. There's no question about that, because it is so elaborate. And really, it's also frowned upon if you buy cookies for the cookie table.
Oh.
Just a big no-no. I mean, you have to be making and freezing cookies sometimes for, months before a wedding to have that volume sufficient enough to show that you, that kind of presentation that so many of us have become accustomed to when you come to weddings in the Midwest and in this case, Western Pennsylvania, which is a bit of an adopted part of the Midwest, which I want to ask you about in a minute. But before we get there, I want to talk about the actual cookies on the table. And I know that everybody's traditions are slightly a little bit different, but from your experience, both personally and maybe any of the research you've done for some of your writing, what are the type of cookies that you may see on the table?
Well, so one of the most important ones are the pinoli, especially among the Italians. Those are made with pine nuts, and they have a light, airy texture to them, and they taste great with espresso. That is a very important cookie that you find at almost all weddings. There's also the rum ball, which is not a baked cookie, but it's made with ground nuts and ground, typically like vanilla wafers and rum and cocoa, and doused, rolled in a ball and doused into in confectionery sugar. That's an important one. And when you're Italian, the Neapolitan cookie, or as the non-Italians call it, the rainbow cookie,
right,
is a critically important cookie, not only because of taste and texture. It's made with marzipan. It has different vibrant jellies in between, traditionally apricot and raspberry, and it has a yellow, pink, and green dough in different layers, and a really dark, bittersweet chocolate hard icing on top. And it's cut like little bricks. Not only is it delicious, it is also incredibly colorful and an important part of a wedding table.
You're making me hungry right now, and
I
you know, I don't know if I'm going to have a chance to bake right this minute, but maybe I could go down to Jimmy's Italian store on Belmont Avenue and get me some of this stuff, which, you know, coming from our vibrant, immigrant rich communities, you can always find an ethnic grocery store, ethnic bakery, which is, we're really blessed to have. And one of the reasons why I've, you know, doing this show is to try to highlight some of the diversity and the richness of our culinary culture throughout our region. One of the cookies that I know that we make is what we call a bonbon cookie. We make it still every year for Christmas, but, you know, it's a lemon or almond. It's kind of shaped a bit like the rum balls that you were talking about, but it's a bit of kind of like a drop cookie, and then it's flavored, it's almond, but then it's flavored with a bit of a very light glaze that's lemon, and then some very colorful sprinkles. And that's one that you can actually look up as, and if you try to find it online, you can actually find it as Italian wedding cookie. Yes. Which I find kind of funny.
What is so wonderful about this tradition is that areas that we grew up in particular the Midwest, people forget places like Pittsburgh or Youngstown or Toledo were known as these melting pots. And as new each generation of immigrants came in, and each wave of immigrants came in, they intermarried. And all of a sudden you had all these great mixes of foods, in particular cookies, at these cookie tables. And you know, food is always the great connector. It comforts us. It pulls us together. We can talk about its construction, its ingredients. One of the other really endearing things about making cookies, while I individually made 3,000 cookies for my daughter's wedding, there was a Sunday afternoon where my mom and my sisters and my daughter and my daughter's future mother-in-law, we pulled out the long tables, we put sheets on them, and we baked for hours. And that sense of community and bonding can't be replaced by any other thing.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because there is that intergenerational aspect to the cookie table. And the fact that, you know, the future mother-in-law was also involved shows how the food is bringing people together, blending the families, developing that sense of camaraderie and passing on tradition and creating new traditions as well by bringing more people in and having that intergenerational experience, you know, passed down from grandmother to mother to daughter. It's just a wonderful tradition and a great visual as you talk about bringing out the long tables and baking for hours. I can have these visions in my head of the flour and the sprinkles and the almonds and the, you know, you mentioned the pine nuts, and I'm sure, you know, food coloring, you name it, lots of powdered sugar, a lot, and I can smell it as well. I'm sure anise was involved somewhere. And if wasn't, I don't know what you're doing.
Pizzelles. I can't believe you didn't mention pizzelles. Of course there's pizzelles.
Yes, I make pizzelles every Christmas as well. And for our listeners who are not as familiar, these are the thin wafered like cookies that kind of are they're round, but they kind of have usually a design on them, kind of like a star shape. And the more traditional Italian way of making them is with anise, which is a licorice flavor. Sometimes people make it with vanilla, they make it with lemon. You can make it any way you want, really, but the traditional way is anise, and they are a staple on the cookie tables, and in our region, actually a staple that you can get in a lot of bakeries, even at chain grocery stores. You can find them to buy in packs of, you know, a dozen that you can take home. So that's how integrated some of these flavors are in the community. You don't necessarily need to just wait to go to a wedding. People are so familiar with these ethnic flavors that you can pick them up at the local grocery store.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I might go do that after we're off the
agreed.
The show.
So I got one more question for you, Selena, because, you know, in this show, we've talked about the Midwest as, you know, a region, but also Midwestern food kind of as a state of mind. And Western Pennsylvania bridges an interesting gap because we don't count Pennsylvania, technically speaking, as part of the Midwest. It's part of the Mid-Atlantic region, as you know, if you're going to get technical with the map. But as you and I know, you know, cultural differences exist, and they even exist in many states. But you know, in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are very different. In Ohio, Cleveland and Cincinnati are very different. And so, you know, Western Pennsylvania, I would say, is an adopted part of the Midwest because culturally, whether it's because we have that connection to industry and the mills and the coal mines and the ethnic immigrants that came to our communities, I feel as if we're closer linked in the Three Rivers area all the way up to Erie, Pennsylvania, than you would be to Philadelphia. And so do you get that sense? And do you feel comfortable being on a show about the Midwest, talking Midwestern food traditions?
Absolutely. I have always considered Pittsburgh part of the Midwest. I mean, from my backyard to the Ohio state line, it's 22 miles.
Right. I'm nine.
Yeah.
To Sharon, PA.
So, you know, we are much more culturally connected to the Midwest. You know, we also have that bit of, and the same goes for where you live. You have that bit of Appalachia in you as well.
Yep.
And so I think that's what between the Midwest and the Appalachia, I think that's what makes Pittsburgh much more connected to Ohio, to Youngstown, even to Cleveland. We are much more similar to Cleveland or Columbus than we are to Philadelphia or New York. We may geographically, on a map, you might say, oh, it looks like you belong here. But if you spend longer than 15 minutes in Pittsburgh, you're like, oh, yeah, this is the Midwest. And it is, as you said, it has a lot to do with our migration patterns. It has a lot to do with industry, also the farming and the less, I don't want to say, not the word sophisticated, but the less city-centric ideals in the way of life. I'm not talking about anything other than way of life. It is a much slower pace here. And that is much more in tune with our Ohio cousins than it is with Philadelphia.
Agreed. And on this final note, we say pop, and so do you. And those guys on the other side of Pennsylvania say soda. And that is fighting words to anybody in the Midwest.
Yeah. Pop is not... We drink pop here, and we also say yins. And I have heard yins over in Youngstown. I've heard it said there.
We have, depending on what side of town you're on. So we're giving a good insight to our listeners about our little corner of the world and just in a 60-mile radius, how much culture we have and how unique we are as a subset of the American Midwest and as Italian Americans sharing this wonderful ethnic tradition of the cookie table. Selena Zito, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day and your busy schedule to be with us.
Thanks so much. It was a blast.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.